Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the intensifying Israeli bombardment of Gaza in response to missiles launched by Hamas. Former Middle East negotiator Aaron David Miller, who served 6 secretaries of state, joins us to discuss the regional implications of this latest confrontation between these two implacable enemies and what diplomatic moves might be possible to avert further military escalation. Then we'll go to northern Afghanistan to speak with author and journalist Robert Young Pelton, who has covered the 11-year-long war from the beginning. He filmed the original deployment of special forces and the Taliban prisoner breakout, in which a CIA officer was killed and the American Taliban John Walker Lind was captured. We'll get a perspective on what U.S. presence will remain after 2014 as the remaining troops and contractors build a series of permanent Fort Apaches in this hostile and increasingly lawless land. Then finally, we will hear from Graham Fuller, a former CIA Kabul station chief who was the vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council. We will continue the discussion on Afghanistan and look into the current soap opera surrounding the scandal-plagued former head of the CIA, whose testimony made fools out of Republican leaders like John McCain and Fox News, who have been grandstanding and beating the drum on Benghazi for months, trying to turn a minor tragedy into a major issue. Joining us now is Aaron David Miller, who's a vice president and distinguished scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He served 6 secretaries of state as Middle East negotiator in Democratic and Republican administrations, and he's the author of the forthcoming book, Can America Have Another Great President? Welcome to Background Briefing, Aaron David Miller.
Pleasure to be here.
So you're calling for restraint on the part of Israel, as well as urging Egypt to press Hamas to control the jihadis. This situation surely is putting enormous pressure not just on Hamas, but Israel's getting a black eye, I think, in public opinion, which they did last time around in 2008. Things are very tense for King Abdullah next door in Jordan. And the Egyptian people are apparently much more radical and against the Camp David Accords than the government itself is, which you point out in an article in CNN, a need a $4 billion loan from the IMF. So none of this looks like it's very welcome to anybody that has a stake in this.
Well, no, that's all true. But so what else is new? I mean, the Middle East has been broken, angry, and dysfunctional now for years. And over the last couple of years, it's even become even more so. And these problems, whether it's Iran's pursuit of a nuclear weapon, the Arab-Israeli conflict, the Arab Spring/winter, and imploding Syria, and even the situation in Gaza, has no solution. There are only outcomes to this. And that was clearly the case in 08 and 09. It led to 4 years of relative tranquility, but Israel and Hamas have no real modus vivendi beyond a de facto sort of stand down. Their military, security, and political goals are fundamentally at odds with one another. So I would suspect, even though the objective would be a longer-term truce, it's going to be very difficult to get it. It's going to be very hard because Hamas will want things. They'll want Rafah to be reestablished, and that's a crossing point which the Israelis have closed on the Egyptian border with Gaza. They're not going to agree to shut down all their smuggling efforts through the tunnels. They'll want a cessation of all targeted killings on the part of the Israelis. So I think you've got a serious problem. At the same time, neither side wants to escalate this into a Operation Cast-Lead 2008-2009 redux. So, as I mentioned at the outcome, this is a question of management. There are no end states here that will guarantee peace and stability.
Well, you mentioned in your article at CNN, Aaron David Miller, that there are lots of newbies within the Hamas umbrella, one of whom is Jaish al-Islam, which played a role in the August 8 attack that left 16 Egyptian soldiers dead in the Sinai. My understanding is that the killing of the Hamas military wing leader, Ahmed al-Jabari, that at least there are some reports in Israel that he was actually more cooperative and was trying to restrain some of these splinter groups.
Well, so, there's one report I've seen by Aluf Ben, which argues that he was Israel's subcontractor. I quote that in a forthcoming article of my own in Foreign Policy this week. I think he may have outlived his usefulness. I think somewhere along the line, the Israelis no longer saw him as someone who had a stake in in essentially keeping things quiet, he was clearly a very important figure in the outreach to try to secure longer-range missiles with greater range, the Fajr 5s. He was a clear part of that. And I think the Israelis calculated, and they tried to kill him at least once before in 08, that he no longer was useful. And they wanted to send an unmistakable signal that high-trajectory fire into Israel was simply not going to be tolerated, at least this round. So I think that's clearly one of the reasons. And as far as the jihadis in Gaza, I think they did play an important role in testing Israeli deterrence and Israel's limitations for accepting this high-trajectory weapons fire. And I think Hamas was either unable or unwilling to control them. So it's one of the factors. And Sinai, of course, has slipped beyond the capacity of either Israel or the Palestinians or the Egyptians to control. And Sinai is a source of smuggling. It's a launching point for terrorist attacks. So I think this is just another indication that there's not going to be a neatly packaged solution to this. And if you're looking for one, I think you picked the wrong conflict analyst.
Well, obviously this is isolating the Palestinian Authority and making them look impotent. But who really runs Hamas, or does anybody run it? I mean, it comes out of the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood, yet the Iranians apparently have always had an influence, and they've just lost their bases or pulled out of Syria because of what's happening to their Sunni brethren in Syria. And it's just difficult to know, and given what you've just told us, Aaron David Miller, that there are all these newbie groups within the Hamas umbrella, and of course the word in Arabic means religious zeal. So I guess could you describe them or compare them, say, to the Quds force in Iran? Are they religious zealots?
I think they're the religious manifestation of Palestinian nationalism, now charged with governing a polity that's very difficult to govern. And I think it's quite clear who's in charge. The balance of power has shifted toward the internal leadership, Ismail Haniyeh and others inside the organization. The loss of Damascus clearly has weakened the external leadership. Khaled Mishal, who was much more interested not in a solution to the Arab-Israeli conflict, but in a political strategy. But he's been weakened. The internal leadership, the military wing inside the country has strengthened. And I think Hamas runs a pretty tight ship, actually. And frankly, given their new responsibilities, given what they want, it has been forced in large part because of Morsi's election, because of the dependence now on Gulf money, to essentially adopt a much more pragmatic line. That's not the case with respect to their policies toward Israel. But even there, they understand they cannot deal the Israelis a strategic blow, and the Israelis know and are not out to fundamentally eliminate the organization because they know they can't. So again, we're back into a neither black nor white outcome. There's going to be a lot of gray here. And I think in terms of the broader implication, my last comment is that it points up the real conundrum here. I mean, Abbas can't settle with the Israelis. He's too weak, and Hamas won't. And Israel plays its own unhelpful role with respect to this process as well. So you have a situation in which, unless there's some fundamental turning, some recalculation on the part of one or more of the parties, you're going to end up seeing these outcomes rather than permanent comprehensive solutions.
But just in closing, if the Gulf money is sustaining Hamas, that wouldn't that exclude Iran as a major sponsor?
Because, you know, in this part of the region, as in American politics, people hedge their bets. Mm-hmm. They basically keep all of their options open. It's certainly possible for Hamas to receive money from the UAE and the Qataris. Maybe not as much from the Saudis, given their allergic reaction to the Iranians, but Iran is a key weapons supplier of these longer-range rockets. So, no, Hamas is, again, trying to have it always in both ways.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Aaron David Miller.
You're welcome.
And I've just been speaking with Aaron David Miller, who is a vice president and distinguished scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He served under six Secretary of States as a Middle East negotiator in Democratic and Republican administrations, and he's the author of the forthcoming book, Can America Have Another Great President? And we're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back and then go to northern Afghanistan. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from the northern part of Afghanistan is Robert Young Pelton, who's an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He's the founder and publisher of SomaliaReport.com, and he's had first-hand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgents groups. His books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns, and The War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurous. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Young Pelton.
Thank you.
So you're back in Afghanistan, and I guess it's some kind of a bookend because you went in with the first American Special Forces in the initial American invasion in response to 9/11. You were there filming, I think, for National Geographic at the time when the American CIA officer was killed. And the American jihadi, John Walker Lind, was captured. So what's the sense now of coming back after all those years? Is it, what kind of progress have we made, I guess, is my question.
Well, you know, I'm here, I guess, exactly 11 years to the day. And I'm with the same type of people doing the same type of thing. So it's fascinating to see the contrast. For example, the city of Mazar-e Sharif is a vast, sprawling metropolis now. And the American presence is also a vast, sprawling metropolis. And the interesting thing is that nobody's throwing anything down. There's a lot of talk on the American side about pulling troops out and sort of pulling out, but nobody actually really was saying that. The America's presence will still remain.
Well, there are reports that the U.S. and the Afghani government, if that's not too generous a description, are in talks trying to craft an agreement of what kind of American footprint there will be after 2014. What's your sense of where... what kind of footprint the U.S. is going to have after the 2014 withdrawal?
Well, first of all, they're building permanent installations over here, so there will be a permanent military presence in Afghanistan. Secondly, they're doing what the Russians tried to do, to set up a 500,000 man security force, but that security force is nowhere near at any level that would provide stability. And there still is fighting. You know, every day there's troops in contact, there's casualties, airstrikes. The war goes on. So what I'm going to imagine is you're going to see a lot of the regular troops be pulled back, but a lot of this is just going to disappear from the headlines. There'll still be American troops with building permanent bases. You just won't see the regular troops, and you won't see much coverage of the actual fighting that'll go on.
So if the U.S. continues fighting and continues its presence, it would obviously need air power to make up for the lack of boots on the ground. How can you maintain an air force in a landlocked country where the Pakistanis control the supply routes and they're obviously supporting the Taliban? How's that going to work out?
I think the whole strategy here is going to go toward very targeted strikes, and there's going to be a large intelligence capability. There's a lot of contractors. There's a lot of special operations troops. And what they're trying to do is just wait until the Afghan forces can actually handle the number of attacks by Taliban and insurgent forces. You know, what's interesting is a lot of the attacks here are not by the Taliban. They're by local groups who are simply fighting against the Karzai government. It's a very different dynamic than it was 10 years ago.
So explain that further. I mean, is this going to revert to
well,
the...
In 2001, you had actually a very large Taliban ground force made out of Pakistani recruits and Afghan soldiers, and they were mechanized, just like a traditional, almost like a Russian army. Today, what you're seeing is numerous small fighting and uprisings in rural areas in which the people may or may not be aligned with the Taliban at all. You're seeing local groups actually fighting against the Karzai government, pushing back from the control of the central government. And it's a very confusing dynamic because, you know, people may have very regional reasons for fighting against the government forces. So you're not seeing that coordinated attack that you saw a long time ago, 10 years ago.
So is this a return to warlordism? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, people see that in 2014, I think April 2014 is when the election is supposed to happen. They know that Karzai won't come back in power, and everybody is consolidating their positions here. So they're not really bowing down to the Afghan army or the Afghan police. They're quite new at what they're doing. And so they're pushing back. If a large military unit goes into a small village, they will actually be attacked, which is quite amazing because they're not respecting the centralized control of force.
Well, the idea of an Afghan national army has always been something of a myth, but I thought that much of its makeup were the non-Pashtun tribes. So if you're in the area of the non-Pashtun tribes, why are they hostile to an army that's largely made up of recruits from their tribes?
Well, I'm north of the Hindu Kush. There are some Pashtun pockets here. But you got to remember, there's Uzbeks, there's Turkmen, there's Hazaras, there's Imak. There's a number of ethnic groups, but there's also a number of business and criminal groups who never actually see the army. And they literally send the army out just to show presence, and the locals will respond by firing back at them. And it's an interesting situation because the idea of providing this $500 million security force is always something that was written on paper. It was never actually something that was exercised. And as you know, it didn't work out that well during the Russian period, and it's probably not going to work out that well during the 2014 transition from American control of force to Afghan control of force.
So, Robert Young Pelton, in northern Afghanistan, it would seem then that what you're talking about here in the post-2014 American deployment, continued deployment in Afghanistan, is kind of a few Fort Apaches in a very hostile land.
You're going to see mission creep because as the traditional forces move out and there's a lot of the infrastructure projects move out, you're going to see bases staffed with Americans, staffed with contractors, partnering with Afghans, everything from local police to army to special forces, desperately trying to keep control over the landscape so that a centralized government in Kabul can claim control. But I think what you're going to see is something very different. And you see this all over the world. You see this in Yemen. You see this in Somalia, where they pretend that there's a central government, but the local people still control their destiny.
So just to get a handle on the supply situation, because, to get a gallon of gasoline to the Marines, for example, in Helmand, I believe, was, $90 a gallon it ends up at, or maybe even over 100. And the Pakistanis have closed off the supply routes on a number of occasions. Is the northern supply route working through the former Soviet Union? Is that secure and viable?
No, the material here is still flowing in. I mean, they actually still fly in aviation gas for aircraft, if you can believe it. and all the American installations all run off generators. There's no economy here. There's no sort of giant wellspring of oil or fuel or supplies. All the food that's served at the American bases is flown in from other countries. They don't buy it locally. But it's still the same sort of bizarre space station supply route.
So again, I'm speaking with Robert Young-Pelton, who is in northern Afghanistan. He went into Afghanistan with the first Special Forces back in 2001, 2002, and is returning after 11 years, having visited a number of times. And we're talking about where things stand. Going back to your experience with the captured prisoners who rioted and killed the CIA officer, all of which you witnessed, and then the American prisoner, John Walker Lind, the Special Forces actually handed him over to you until the Marines came and put him in custody. So you've had quite a long experience and interest in what's happening there. I mean, you went in with an older generation of Special Forces, much more seasoned. The newer generation that you're in with now, are they as kind of smart and I guess cautious is the word to say?
I have to say the new generation is actually more aggressive than the old generation, but the command structure is very risk averse. I mean, you have to remember in 2001 when Special Forces landed here, they were on horseback and they were happy to get one of their six-wheeled gators after their campaign. Today, they have to drive in MRAPs and 52,000-pound mine-resistant vehicles. And there are extraordinary number of restrictions on the use of violence, airstrikes, et cetera, et cetera. So we're sort of micromanaging a very risk-averse war right now.
But the original Special Forces were a little more attuned to culture and local customs. Are these soldiers that are going to be staying behind? Are they going to be in tune with the people or just, hunkered down in forts, feeling isolated and paranoid? That's the picture I'm seeing. But
yeah, well, the new generation very much wants to live amongst the population, but they can't. They have to stay on military bases. They work hand in hand. They're right there in combat with Afghan soldiers, and many times they get caught up in the same kind of violence and casualties and problems that the Afghan soldiers have. So they are probably closer to the battle than at any time in our history here. But yes, they're not allowed to live sort of in the city or in the villages amongst the people, but they are trying to set up a very village-centric type of defense force, which is what we should have done 10 years ago, is we sort of go to each village and let them form their own security apparatus, because the larger army is probably not working that well. It really doesn't have the same kind of fight or heart that the local villagers do. So today, Special Forces troops are better trained, better equipped, but at the same time, they're micromanaged. And they're prevented from doing the very thing they're trained to do best, which is to get out into the boonies and fight alongside the Afghans.
So you mentioned, Robert Young-Pelton, the Karzai government and the elections in 2014, which Karzai, of course, can't run again, but he's trying to influence the outcome. But the impression that you get, that I get at least from talking to specialists on Afghanistan, is that the Karzai clan are essentially a bunch of narco-kleptocrats, and they've parked God knows how much money in Dubai, much of which has come from the American taxpayer. And then, of course, there's that proliferation of what they call poppy palaces in Kabul, in the wealthy neighborhoods. Give us a sense of the difference between the elites and their poppy palaces and these kind of mud brick villages that the Special Forces are trying to defend.
Right. Well, as you know, we've poured billions of dollars into Afghanistan, and we have created a process that forces us to push that money through the government so that the government looks like it's handing out this money. of course, that government has skimmed off large amounts of that government of that money. When you get out to the Afghan villages, they look exactly the same as they did 10, 20, 30 years ago, and they haven't seen much impact of the central government. Many of these people are very aware that they can vote and that they want to change or have some kind of benefit from the government, but I think they've turned away from the idea that a central government will solve their problems. So we're seeing more regionalization of politics, and the people that actually put Karzai back into power, which is, of course, General Dostum and Mahathir and these ethnic minorities, have banded together. They provided 42% of Karzai's vote last time. And so they're busy working on the grassroots part of the politics. And I don't know what's going to happen in 2014, but the people here in Afghanistan are both somewhat despondent that they think the Americans are leaving, and at the same time, you know, hopeful that Karzai will leave. They don't have an answer. They don't have some person picked out that they'd like to see in power. But they're not very happy that Obama has publicly said that we're leaving the country, even though privately we're not.
So what about, though, the morale amongst the U.S. forces there? If they, I mean, how are they reacting, for example, to the much-storied General Petraeus, who, of course, is responsible for the surge that didn't seem to amount to very much in terms of achievements? And then, of course, you got General Allen, the general in charge, supposedly to be heading up NATO soon. He's swept up in this scandal, which is really kind of a tawdry soap opera involving a bunch of sort of tacky people down in Florida. How do the officers and men there in Afghanistan, how are they responding to this soap opera?
Well, I think American troops in Afghanistan they like the country, they like the mission, they want to do something, but they're almost shocked at the way that the higher levels conduct themselves. For example, you know, General McKinney was fired, General McChrystal was fired, General Petraeus was brought in, you know, to patch up his program here. General Allen seems to be in trouble. It just seems to be an odd run of bad luck at the high command. And there's been a number of shifts in programs from the top down. And I know, you know, I can't speak exactly about what I know, but at the same time, I've seen that exact micromanagement where the ground troops know how to fight the war, but yet people at the head said will micromanage what they do for some political, you know, either based on discussions with the Karzai government or trying to manage risk here. So you see two goals. One is to win the war, which I don't think will happen. And the second one is to protect the lives and the safety of the troops within the confines of the Afghan legal environment. It's quite confusing.
But, I mean, there's been 11 commanders in 11 years. That's got to be a little confusing for the people down the ranks, surely.
Well, one thing to remember is that, you know, we were supposed to shift our military focus from Europe and Japan towards the Middle East, and Iraq was supposed to be one of our strategic toeholds, and we lost that when the Iraqis didn't sign the agreement. So Afghanistan is really our next big permanent toehold, you know, in between sort of the Iran and other sort of fragile countries here. So I think even though politically President Obama wants us to end the war in Afghanistan, we're actually not. We're just going to shift into another phase.
So, in other words, they want to somehow get the Afghans to shoulder the so-called burden, and get most of the U.S. troops out, but they also want to maintain a permanent presence through bases in that neighborhood. Is that the summary?
Well, you've seen this in the drone war in Pakistan. You know, theoretically, we're not at war, and yet we fly hundreds of drone missions and kill thousands of people every year, and yet we're not at war in Pakistan. And you're seeing a very disturbing shift from open wars to covert wars. For example, in Mali, we're starting like a new proxy war to clear out al-Qaeda, just like we did in Somalia, where we paid Uganda, you know, to fight our war in Somalia. So you're seeing a shift from public wars to private wars. You see the politicians insist that we're not fighting a war over here. And yes, we very much are fighting a war over here.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us and giving us your unique perspective since... Robert Young Pelton, you've been there from the beginning, and you're just back there now for a month. I thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, and as always.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Young Pelton, who's an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He's the founder and publisher of Somalia Report, and he has had a first-hand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. His books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. And we're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with a former CIA Kabul station chief.
The newborn of the hammock rocks below a bolted sky that unlocks for the departing of the flocks from the shadow of an empire. God loves a trier, an articulate liar.
Dirty little secrets, dirty little lies. We got our dirty little fingers in everybody's pie. We love to cut you down to size. We love dirty laundry. We can do the innuendo.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Graham Fuller, who is the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. Graham Fuller has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including The Future of Political Islam and A World Without Islam. His latest book is Three Truths and a Lie, a memoir. Welcome to Background Briefing, Graham Fuller.
Thank you, Ian.
And obviously, I want to continue the discussion about Afghanistan. Having just spoken, I'm sorry about the connection, but he's on a cell phone somewhere in the north of Afghanistan. Apparently, the Taliban...
Sounds very romantic.
But the Taliban apparently regularly blow up cell phone towers. So we did the best we could. Were you able to hear it okay?
Fair amount of it, yes.
Yeah, okay. I'm sorry. And I apologize to our audience, too. But I thought it was an important thing to have somebody that's had this long perspective, having gone in there in the beginning.
Absolutely.
And 11 years later. But let's just, if we can, before we begin with Afghanistan, just touch on the big stories involving the CIA, Graham Fuller. There is, of course, this soap opera surrounding the current, well, it was the leader of the CIA, now he's resigned, General Petraeus. So he's the, you know, the scandal plagued former head, but his recent testimony, from what we know before this Senate Select Intelligence Committee, essentially made fools out of the Republican leaders like John McCain and Lindsey Graham and others, as well as Fox News, who have been grandstanding and beating the drum on Benghazi for months, trying to turn a minor tragedy into a major issue. At least that's my perspective. What's yours?
Well, I think that's right on the mark, Ian. I mean, basically, I think this is a struggle among personalities and powers in Washington with fairly thin gruel as far as the nature of scandals or who knew what and when. And certainly the fact that it came around right at the end of the electoral campaign heightened the whole business. So I really don't seriously think there is a strategic issue worth discussing here. I I am. I know that Petraeus is quite a bright mind and a serious thinker about a lot of issues, but I think a lot of people do feel that the so-called surge in Iraq was whatever did happen there was the product largely of other events and forces that were taking place, and even less successful in Afghanistan. So, you know, whatever his virtues as a military commander and officer and thinker, I would regret the appointment, and this isn't the first time, obviously, of a military man to head CIA. I think the military has lots of very serious and very good thinkers, but they also command a huge proportion of geopolitical turf in the world, and I do regret seeing essentially civilian institutions slightly militarized and brought in under the wing of military thinking, as was the case in appointing Petraeus to head of CIA. So I don't know, there are a lot of things going on, but nothing that I consider strategically significant. It's all domestic politics.
Well, apparently, from what I understand, Petraeus's tenure at the CIA, he actually apparently found it quite uncomfortable where in the culture of the CIA, junior officers are encouraged to speak up. And apparently Petraeus wasn't used to that. He's used to the more top-down, disciplined, giving orders, etc.
Well, that's right. These are two very, very different cultures, and I think the CIA in some ways is almost a unique culture because, in principle, their only mission is to get it right. They're not supposed to, and in theory, do not set the course of policy. They're supposed to stay far away from that. They're not supposed to take sides in policy discussions, but they are expected to provide accurate and long-range thinking on what is taking place. So that's just one more reason. It doesn't take a military officer in that position to be intolerant of independent thinking coming up from the ranks. There have been a lot of civilian leaders as well who have done that. But yes, if you can't speak your mind, even as a junior officer, if you really have a sense of what's going on, if you can't speak your mind, then the organization might as well close its doors.
So do you think that Petraeus's departure and his testimony to the Senate Select Intelligence Committee, do you think that's going to put an end to this Benghazi business? Because the whole thing, obviously it's a tragedy, but it really, it's also stems from a somewhat personal nature, the fact that the American ambassador was on a private personal trip to Benghazi to visit his Arab boyfriend, who was a local guy, and that's why the security wasn't and the footprint wasn't so big. So it seems to me that, given the private nature of this, it'd be better if everybody just shut the hell up.
Yes, as I say, I just don't think there are any serious strategic issues to be discussed. You can argue about whether you should have more protection or less protection, but the fact is, this is a dangerous mission, and these are dangerous countries. And when the United States is militarily involved across the region, there are plenty of aggrieved people, and not only just citizens, but obviously radical groups, some violent, some nonviolent terrorist groups of all kinds. So, sadly, American ambassadors and other American officials are prime targets. How do you run an embassy in which, in theory, your people are supposed to get out and on the ground and mix in society to gain information, knowledge, and know people, and at the same time protect them from attack? It's almost a mission impossible.
Again, I'm speaking with Graham Fuller, who's a former vice chair of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief, and he's the author of The Future of Political Islam and A World Without Islam. And his latest book is Three Truths and a Lie, a memoir. And just back to Afghanistan, we've spoken before about Afghanistan, and you have a long history with Afghanistan. And I recall you suggesting that in many ways, the problem, the U.S.'s problem in the Middle East, in both in Iraq and in particular in Afghanistan, is the very footprint itself, that much of our problems will go away when we reduce our footprint in these Muslim lands. Is that going to happen, do you think, in Afghanistan?
You know, Ian, I don't know. Yes, I think it's going to happen, not because we expect it or intend it to happen, but because simply it's going to prove untenable to maintain that kind of footprint. You know, by the way, I find even the word footprint a bit ironic, because it does suggest a very heavy impact on the region, and yet I noticed the Pentagon for a long, long time now has never had the least sense of irony about talking about the idea of a footprint. But you know, when you have footprint, people get stepped on, and it's not the best word in the world to describe an American presence. I think the State Department prefers the word presence. But in any case, yeah, I don't think it's ever been particularly realistic. I think the entire Afghan war has been, for that matter also the Iraq war, highly unrealistic in the on its foundations. And the idea that somehow we are going to be able to maintain bases there, when certainly the next government, and when it and after U.S. troops have gone, the Taliban's presence will be, or footprint, if you want to call it, the Taliban footprint will be vastly greater. I don't want to predict that they're going to run the country entirely. Then that's not a foregone conclusion, but it's going to be a lot less friendly. We're going to have a lot less pliable leadership there. The Pakistanis will have a lot of say in it, which is not anti-American, but it's not pro-American either. So I really wonder how long and to what end, more to the point, to what end we can maintain a presence there that is seemingly non-military, but yet is, and increasingly operated by people who are not professional intelligence officers, training a military that is perhaps an Afghan military that is already heavily infiltrated by people who are anti-American. But particularly, as I say, to what end? We don't have to have American military presence in Afghanistan to try to keep al-Qaeda bases from appearing. I think in the end, the good case can be made that an Afghan government down the road, even a Taliban-influenced government, is not going to find it in its interest to be nourishing little al-Qaeda groups, if they are there, in the interests of getting Western or global support, money, finances, investment, and that type of thing.
Well, even the last Taliban government, the only people that recognized it and supported it were Pakistan and the Saudi Arabians. And the Saudis are not going to give them a dime, you know, since they're implacable enemies of al-Qaeda.
Well, that's right. And even nobody looks into it very much, but even the Taliban were extremely uncomfortable with the presence of al-Qaeda in the last, in the months before leading up to 9/11 and afterwards. Would in the end, there's a good case can be made that they in the end would have told bin Laden to leave. But I think the Bush administration at that time was in no mood to negotiate in any way whatsoever. I'm not saying there's certainty it would have worked, that he would have been expelled, but there's certainly a possibility of that. And Bush did not wish even to explore that. I think he wanted to move into a war mode.
So, Graham Fuller, the previous guest, Robert Young Pelton, was talking about how we're moving from open wars to covert wars. We're shifting from public wars to private wars. How much is that practical in Afghanistan, the idea that we create these Fort Apaches manned by special forces and contractors, you know, ad infinitum? And the point he was making is that we lost our foothold in Iraq, and Afghanistan's all we've got in that neighborhood.
Well, all we've got is something I think needs to be examined. I think in this day and age, there's a serious question about how the wisdom of trying to plant a major American military base in the heart of Central Asia that is essentially designed to check China and Russia. I don't think that kind of a presence is critical or even helpful in so-called checking China or Russia. The American dealings of relations with China and Russia are going to be taking place all over the globe, and I would really see that kind of a presence as essentially an irritant and a throwback to the old Cold War era of ringing China or ringing Russia or whatever with American bases. Given the contemporary military power, you don't have to have a base right on the Chinese or Russian, close to the Russian border, to make a point. So I'm not very open to the suggestion of, oh my God, we've lost Iraq and now we're going to lose Afghanistan. As a presence, I think it's disastrous that we have lost, quote unquote, both of these efforts, because it's destroying American credibility, not some military credibility, yes, but also diplomatic credibility and strategic credibility in our inability to manage the task ahead of us, including dealing with terrorism through the extremely heavy-handed, clumsy means of a military approach. It's not essentially a military problem. So yeah, I'm not. It may be a little lower profile to have contractors there. With all due respect, I think the contractors will be even less well informed and less well disciplined, with less of a tradition of service than, say, in the military or in special forces or CIA or DIA or any of these things. I think it represents a winding down and a deterioration of the quality and capability. And ultimately, as I say, to what end? Surely these guys are going to be targets of anti-American forces, whether it's al-Qaeda or other anti-American groups. After a long American military presence there in a war over 11 years, there are lots and lots of aggrieved people who don't have to sign up with Bin Laden's organization to want to take out some Americans. So I think it's going to be a very rough and ultimately losing game, even in a more covert basis.
So, Graham Fuller, if as a lot of people predict, the Taliban will come back, whether they'll take over the entire country or not, you may go back to a kind of the going back to the original situation before 9/11, where the Northern Alliance had a toehold in the north, and the Taliban had basically the rest of the country. I don't quite understand the motivations of the Pakistanis, who clearly support the Taliban and have been undermining the U.S. effort from day one and hedging their bets for a future. Now, they know the U.S. is leaving, so you can understand them wanting to hedge their bets. But on the other hand, why would the Pakistanis want to have a radical government in Afghanistan that's only going to create blowback? They have their own problems with the so-called Pakistan Taliban.
That's exactly right, Ian, but I think we've got to look at the demographics and the geopolitics of the area, which go back a long way. I mean, these people are in the neighborhood forever, and they know, as you say, the American presence is fleeting at best in a historical sense. So the basic fact is that there is Pashtun nationalism, the Pashtun population, which is not quite half of the Afghan population. And if there are the number of Pashtun, there are double the amount of Pashtuns who live on the Pakistan side of the border. The Pashtuns are a very, very important element within the Pakistani society and military and political order. So Pakistan cannot afford. In Pakistan, traditional geopolitical thinking, with this Goliath of India to its east, it cannot afford to be lose strategic depth by having a hostile Afghanistan on the west. So therefore, they know that the connections between the Pashtuns, the huge Pashtun population in Pakistan, and that in Afghanistan is an integral. The border is not even meaningful in that sense. These people cross back and forth. They're the same tribes. They speak the same language. It's long-term same culture. So this is not really a meaningful border. Any Pakistani government that wants to have good relations with Afghanistan has to be in close and tight with the Pashtun population of Afghanistan. And that's their policy. If these guys are Taliban, so be it. They'll try to control them, moderate them. I think they have or will. But the fact that we've had a raging war right on the Pakistani border is simply radicalized Pakistan's politics itself, and into really an alarming measure. I've never seen such a radical Pakistan, and ever since the state has the Pakistan state was established in late 1940. So that is their calculus. We are going to work with the we're going to work with the Pashtuns, and if the Taliban tend to be the dominant force among them, then that's the way it's going to be.
Well, Graham Fuller, you know, the anti-Americanism in Pakistan is just over the top. It's unbelievable. For example, the young girl that was shot by the Taliban, Malala, who's getting medical treatment in England, the prevailing opinion within Pakistan is that the CIA shot her. I mean, it's unbelievable.
I know it is absolutely unbelievable, but the more you have violence and American drone attacks, which I think have much of the Pashtun areas of Pakistan really up in arms and angry and fearful that these things are going to land on them at any point. They are not the fanaticism is ratcheted up, and it's Pashtun nationalism, but then it mixes with Islam to become even a more potent mixture of hostility to outside forces, to outside the footprints of foreigners in the area who they see as doing nothing but bringing damage to their nation and in this losing conflict in Afghanistan.
So, Graham Fuller, as a result of the Afghanistan, the U.S. reduces, I hesitate to use the word again, footprint, but if they get out, would a diminishing presence in Afghanistan, in Pakistan also make sense? Or in other words, it doesn't look like the Pakistanis need an excuse for their anti-Americanism, but is there much that the U.S. can do to reduce it? I don't know how you kind of basically cut bait with a country that has these nuclear weapons, but on the other hand, my understanding is the Pakistanis kind of use their nuclear arsenal as a form of blackmail by saying, you know, you can't afford not to give us funds to keep us solvent, otherwise the place will fall apart and the nukes will get loose.
Well, I don't think the Pakistani military has always been a pretty tight-run organization, and I don't think that they have quite engaged in a nuclear blackmail scenario quite like that. But look, you know, I hate to say it, but I think the most single important thing the U.S. can do is remove the footprint. This is perhaps the right word. It is an intensely aggravating factor in Afghan life, and because Pashtuns, in the end, they're Taliban. The Taliban and the Pashtuns are hard to separate out. But I mean, to the extent that that Pashtuns are involved, Pakistan just is not going to let go on the Afghan side, and they basically want to see U.S. forces out so that the region can begin to calm down. It's going to take quite a while. But it will calm down eventually, because I think once you remove the, you know, the foreign military presence that's so aggravating. I mean, I think as Americans, we should appreciate what it would be like, saying, having Chinese or Indian or Nigerian troops, you know, all over our country, keeping the peace, quote unquote, or whatever else it was. I mean, we know from American Revolutionary history what it was like having British officers speaking exact same language among us. So I think what American thinking has been quite incapable, insensitive of thinking what the impact of this foreign footprint is. When that footprint is gone, it can begin to deal, I think, with the reality and not deal with the sort of shadow boxing. When you have Americans in Afghanistan, American troops, and huge American presence, then that's the center pole around which the whole game is played. If I'm trying to gain influence in Afghanistan as a Pashtun or as a Northerner, as a Tajik or whatever, I'm going to have to play off the American forces as well. It's an almost unnatural presence. Once that presence is gone, I think it is going to be messy, for sure. It's very messy now. But people are going to have to start dealing with each other and getting down to the fundamentals of creating some kind of new arrangement. And in that capacity, I hope regional states that have great influence, Iran has huge influence on Western Afghanistan. Russia has big influence. China can have influence, particularly economic, and India and Pakistan, of course. But unfortunately, I think Washington had, at least in the past, been reluctant to allow certainly Iran to have anything to do whatsoever with a solution, reluctant to let Russia and reluctant even to let China. So we've got to allow regional forces who have a huge stake in this game, bigger than we do, although we're reluctant to admit it. But it matters more to China and Russia and Pakistan and India than it does to us. Let them pick up some of the strategic problems and try to work on it.
So maybe pull the footprint out and let China deal with Pakistan. If indeed you don't need all of these bases, as you say. Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Graham Fuller. I appreciate the time you're able to spend.
My pleasure, Ian.
And
we'll
revisit you soon. I want to talk to you about this extraordinary new book that you've got, Three Truths and a Lie, a memoir.
Okay, great. With pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Graham Fuller, who is the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. Graham Fuller has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including The Future of Political Islam and A World Without Islam. His latest book is Three Truths and a Lie, a Memoir. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can contact me and ask questions if you have them at the moment. And the conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.